After a 35-day journey from Calcutta, the Jaladutta reached Boston's Commonwealth Pier at 5:30 a.m. on 17 September 1965. The ship was to stop briefly in Boston before proceeding to New York City. Among the first things Srila Prabhupada saw in America were the letters A and P painted on a pierfront warehouse. The gray waterfront dawn revealed the ships in the harbor, a conglomeration of lobster stands and drab buildings, and, rising in the distance, the Boston skyline. Prabhupada had to pass the U.S. Immigration and Customs in Boston. His visa allowed him a 3-month stay, and an official stamped it to indicate his expected date of departure. Captain Pandya invited Prabhupada to take a walk into Boston, where the captain intended to do some shopping. They walked across a footbridge into a busy commercial area with old churches, warehouses, office buildings, bars, tawdry bookshops, nightclubs, and restaurants. Prabhupada briefly observed the city, but the most significant thing about his short stay in Boston, aside from the fact that he had now set foot in America, was that at Commonwealth Pier, he wrote another Bengali poem entitled Markine Bhagavat Dharma, Teaching Krishna Consciousness in America. Some of the verses he wrote on board the ship that day are as follows. My dear Krishna, you are so kind upon this useless soul, but I do not know why you have brought me here. Now you can do whatever you like with me. But I guess you have some business here. Otherwise, why would you bring me to this terrible place? Most of the population here is covered by the material modes of ignorance and passion. Absorbed in material life, they think themselves very happy and satisfied, and therefore they have no taste for the transcendental message of Vasudeva, Krishna. I do not know how they will be able to understand it. But I know that your causeless mercy can make everything possible, because you are the most expert mystic. How they will understand the mellows of devotional service, O Lord. I am simply praying for your mercy so that I be able to convince them about your message. All the living entities have come under the control of the illusory energy by your will. And therefore, if you like, by your will, they can also be released from the clutches of illusion. I wish that you may deliver them. Therefore, if you so desire their deliverance, then only will they be able to understand your message. How will I make them understand this message of Krishna consciousness? I am very unfortunate, unqualified, and the most fallen. Therefore, I am seeking your benediction so that I can convince them, for I am powerless to do so on my own. Somehow or other, O Lord, you have brought me here to speak about you. Now, my Lord, it is up to you to make me a success or failure, as you like. O spiritual master of all the worlds, I can simply repeat your message. So if you like, you can make my power of speaking suitable for their understanding. Only by your causeless mercy will my words become pure. I am sure that when this transcendental message penetrates their hearts, they will certainly feel gladdened and thus become liberated from all unhappy conditions of life. O Lord, I am just like a puppet in your hands. So if you have brought me here to dance, then make me dance. Make me dance, O Lord. Make me dance as you like. I have no devotion, nor do I have any knowledge, but I have strong faith in the holy name of Krishna. I have been designated as Bhakti Vedanta, and now, if you like, you can fulfill the real purport of Bhakti Vedanta. Signed, the most unfortunate, insignificant beggar, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, on board the ship Jaladuta, Commonwealth Pier, Boston, Massachusetts, USA, dated 18th September, 1965. He was now in America. He was in a major American city, rich with billions, populated with millions, and determined to stay the way it was. Yeah, Boston's the city where all the big, universities are. Many of the old famous, Harvard is there, MIT is there. There's 10 universities there. So it's known very much for it being academic and everything. So as it is, they all think that they're doing fine, right? Prabhupada saw Boston from the viewpoint of a pure devotee of Krishna. He saw the hellish city life, people dedicated to the illusion of material happiness. All his dedication and training moved him to give these people the transcendental knowledge and saving grace of Krishna consciousness. Yet he was feeling weak, lowly, and unable to help them on his own. He was but, quote, an insignificant beggar, no, end quote, with no money. He had barely survived the 2 heart attacks at sea. He spoke a different language. He dressed strangely. Yet he had come to tell people to give up meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling, and to teach them to worship Lord Krishna, who was to them a mythical Hindu god. What would he be able to accomplish? Hopelessly, he spoke his heart directly to God. Quote, I wish that you may deliver them. I am seeking your benediction, so that I may convince them. And for convincing them, he would trust in the power of God's holy name and in the Srimad Bhagavatam. This transcendental sound would clean away desire for material enjoyment from their hearts and awaken loving service to Krishna. On the streets of Boston, Prabhupada was aware of the power of ignorance and passion that dominated the city, but he had faith in the transcendental process. He was tiny, but God was infinite, and God was Krishna, his dear friend. On the 19th of September, the Jaladuta sailed into New York Harbor and docked at a Brooklyn pier at 17th Street. Srila Prabhupada saw the awesome Manhattan skyline, the Empire State Building, and like millions of visitors and immigrants in the past, the Statue of Liberty. Srila Prabhupada was dressed appropriately for a resident of Vrindavan. He wore kanti mala, necklace, and a simple cotton dhoti, and he carried japa mala, chanting beads, and an old chadar or shawl. His complexion was golden, his head shaven, sika in the back, his forehead decorated with a whitish Vaishnav tilak. He wore pointed white rubber slippers, not uncommon for sadhus in India. But who in New York had ever seen or dreamed of anyone appearing like this Vaishnav? He was possibly the first Vaishnav sannyasi to arrive in New York with uncompromised appearance. What does uncompromised appearance mean?
He keeps his standards?
Yes, he maintained his standards. It means others would come and adjust themselves. Like I think there's a picture of Vivekananda in America in a, you know, in a three-piece suit and all that, you know, nicely combed hair and a girl on each arm. You know, there's a picture like that, actually. And everybody thinks, oh, so great. Of course, New Yorkers have an expertise in not giving much attention to any kind of strange new arrival. Right? It means, like, if you walk down the street dressed as you are now, you probably won't even get any attention. They're very expert at just ignoring anything. But if you're wearing peg shoes, that they'll notice, because that they've never seen before. You know, so it's like. But otherwise, the robes, the tilak, the shaved head doesn't bother them at all, because everybody's got some weirdo thing, you know, like that. Srila Prabhupada was on his own. He had a sponsor, Mr. Agarwal, somewhere in Pennsylvania. Surely someone would be here to greet him. Although he had little idea of what to do as he walked off the ship onto the pier, quote, I did not know whether to turn left or right, end quote. He passed through the dockside formalities and was met by a representative from Traveler's Aid, sent by the Agarwals in Pennsylvania, who offered to take him to the Scindia ticket office in Manhattan to book his return passage to India. At the Scindia office, Prabhupada spoke with the ticket agent, Joseph Forrester, who was impressed by this unusual passenger's Vaishnav appearance, his light luggage, and his apparent poverty. He regarded Prabhupada as a priest. Most of Scindia's passengers were businessmen or families, so Mr. Forrester had never seen a passenger wearing the traditional Vaishnav dress of India. He found Srila Prabhupada to be, quote, a pleasant gentleman, end quote, who spoke of, quote, the nice accommodations and treatment he had received aboard the Jaladuta, end quote. Prabhupada asked Mr. Forrester to hold place for him on a return ship to India. His plans were to leave in about 2 months, and he told Mr. Forrester that he would keep in touch. Carrying only 40 rupees in cash, which he himself called, quote, a few hours spending in New York, end quote, and an additional $20 he had collected from selling three volumes of Bhagavatam to Captain Pandya, Srila Prabhupada, with umbrella and suitcase in hand, and still escorted by the traveler's aid representative, set out for the Port Authority bus terminal to arrange for his trip to Butler. Right, it's Butler, Pennsylvania. Heading off. Right. So already you're on the, you know, strange corner of the world, and then you go out into the middle of nowhere. Right. Chapter 2. Butler, Pennsylvania, the first testing ground. Quote from a letter. By the grace of Lord Krishna, the Americans are prosperous in every respect. They are not poverty-stricken like the Indians. The people in general are satisfied so far as their material needs are concerned, and they are spiritually inclined. When I was in Butler, Pennsylvania, about 500 miles from New York, I saw there many churches, and they were attending regularly. This shows that they are spiritually inclined. I was also invited by some churches and church-governed schools and colleges, and I spoke there, and they appreciated it and presented me some token of rewards. When I was speaking to the students, they were very eager to hear about the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam. But the clergymen were cautious about allowing students to hear me so patiently. They feared that the students might be converted to Hindu ideas, as is quite natural for any religious sect. But they do not know that devotional service of Lord Sri Krishna is the common religion for everyone, including even the aborigines and cannibals in the jungle. From a letter to Sumati Muraji. The bus came swinging out of the terminal into the daylight of midtown Manhattan, riding along in the shadows of skyscrapers, through asphalt streets crowded with people, trucks, and automobiles, and into the heavy traffic bound towards the Lincoln Tunnel. The bus entered the tunnel and emerged on the Jersey side of the Hudson River. In other words, so you said Manhattan's an island, so then you either have to go across a bridge or a tunnel that goes under the rivers. One side, I think you have the Hudson. I'm not sure what's on the other side, but there's two rivers. You know, it means it comes down and one's on one side, one's on the other. So you have to cross one of them to get the other side. So you're either going over to Jersey or over to Brooklyn or over to Queens or over to, I think, was it Brooklyn? No, what's it? Can't remember, but there's all kinds of strange and wonderful places there. The Bronx, yes, that's the real rough area, the Bronx, yes. The bus entered the tunnel and emerged on the Jersey side of the Hudson River, so that means the other side, Jersey side's where all the Indians live now. Continuing down the New Jersey Turnpike is like a highway. I'm not sure why they call it a turnpike, but somehow or another, there's a reason why one's a highway and one's a turnpike. I'm not exactly sure. Past fields of huge oil tanks and sprawling refineries. The Manhattan skyline was on the left, while three lanes of traffic sped 60 miles an hour in each direction. Newark Airport came up close on the right, with jets visible on the ground. Electric power lines spanning aloft between steel towers stretched into the horizon. Any of you, understand miles as opposed to kilometers? Yeah? Can you even understand kilometers? Yeah? So a mile is like a kilometer is like 2/3 of a mile. So if it says 60 miles an hour, it means they're doing 90 kilometers. Right down, yeah? Srila Prabhupada had never before witnessed anything of such magnitude. He was now seeing for himself that American culture was based on passion for more and more sense gratification. And it was a scene of madness. For what important business were people rushing to and fro at breakneck speed? He could see their goals advertised on the billboards. Yeah, so by studying the billboards, if you go somewhere, you can understand what their goals are. Of course, he had many times traveled the road from Delhi to Vrindavan, but it did not have many advertisements. A traveler would see mostly the land, roadside streams, temples, homes, farmers in their fields. Most people went on foot or traveled by ox cart or bicycle. And in Vrindavan, even the ordinary passerby greeted each other by calling the names of God, Jai Radhe, Hare Krishna. Now there are factories outside Delhi, but nothing like this. The cumulative effect did not pack nearly the materialistic punch of these fields of oil tanks, mammoth factories, and billboards alongside the crowded superhighway. Meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling, the very sins Srila Prabhupada had come to preach against, were proudly glamorized on mile after mile of billboards. The signs promoted liquor and cigarettes. Roadside restaurants offered slaughtered cows in the form of steaks and hamburgers. And no matter what the product, it was usually advertised by a lusty-looking woman. But Prabhupada had come to teach the opposite, that happiness is not found in the passion for sense gratification, and that only when one becomes detached from the mode of passion, which leads to sinful acts, can one become eligible for the eternal happiness of Krishna consciousness. It means ignorance, basically, you'll do nothing, right? You know, you sit around and not do a whole lot, or what you'll do will really be stupid. Oh, excuse me. Mode of passion then makes one very active to do things and get things done and accomplish things. You know, and you actually are generally able to accomplish it. Right? But in the processes, it always leads to the sinful activities because you accomplish something and then you want more. So you just keep going more and more and more. And so it goes beyond what is, you know, comes out of something naturally. So then one gets into sinful activities. Right? So therefore, is their whole lifestyle, the whole basis of their culture was based on the very principles of, you know, that are against Krishna consciousness. It means the Western culture works because of its not following the regulative principles. That gives it its inspiration. Otherwise, why are people going to work so hard? Why are they going to live in such hellish conditions like that? Right? Because they're inspired because they feel they're going to get something more. Like that. Unfortunately, they don't. But, you know, that's the greatness of illusion, is that you think you're getting something when you're not actually getting. Yes? No? Maybe? Very good. Call. Okay. Prabhupada felt compassion. The compassion of a Krishna conscious saint had been explained in an age long ago by Prahlad Maharaj. Quote, I see that there are many saintly persons indeed, but they are interested only in their own deliverance. Not caring for the big cities and towns, they go to the Himalayas or the forest to meditate with vows of silence. They are not interested in delivering others. As for me, however, I do not wish to be liberated alone, leaving aside all these poor fellows and rascals. I know that without Krishna consciousness, without taking shelter of your lotus feet, one cannot be happy. Therefore, I wish to bring them back to shelter at your lotus feet. End quote. So that's Prahlad Maharaj. So he does mention here the big cities and towns. The scenery gradually changed into the Pennsylvania countryside, and the bus sped along through long tunnels in the mountains. Night came, and it was late, after 11, when the bus entered the heavily industrialized Pittsburgh area. On the shore of the Allegheny River, Srila Prabhupada couldn't see the steel mills clearly, but he could see their lights and their industrial fires and smoking stacks. Millions of lights shone throughout the city's prevailing dinginess. It's amazing. So much light, but they're so dingy. New York's like that. The place is really dingy, but somehow or another, you know, very well lit. When the bus finally pulled into the terminal, it was past midnight. Gopal Agarwal was waiting with the family Volkswagen, a family Volkswagen bus, to drive Prabhupada to Butler, about an hour north. He greeted Prabhupada with folded hands and, quote, "Welcome, Swamiji," end quote, bowing from the waist several times. This was not any of Gopal's doing. His father, a Mathura businessman with a fondness for sadhus and religious causes, had requested him to host the Swamiji. This wasn't the first time his father had arranged for a sadhu acquaintance to come to America. Several times he had sent sponsorship papers for Gopal to sign, and Gopal had obediently done so, but nothing had ever come of them. So when the sponsorship letter for A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami had come, Gopal had promptly signed and returned it, thinking that this would be the last he would hear of it. But when just a week ago a letter came, Sally Agarwal had opened it and then, in alarm, called to her husband. "Honey," quote, "honey, sit down. Listen to this. The Swami is coming," end quote. Srila Prabhupada had enclosed his picture so that they would not mistake him. They wouldn't probably anyway.
That's how meticulous he was.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, exact all details. And he'd do it by letter, and he would get everything on time and everything. He used to get really upset with the devotees because they wouldn't use letters and do everything in time or telegrams. They always had to call at the last minute, use the telephone to make, you know, manage the arrangements. So you'd always get upset with them. Why they couldn't, you know, you have a plan, you know, after 2 weeks of doing this, you send a letter, it'll be there in 2 days or something. But, you know, they wait until the last minute and then they have to call and frantically running around like, you know, madmen and everything. So probably was very, it was said was 7,000 letters, you know, over 11 years, you know, are in the archives.
Like that. That's just in the archives.
Yeah. Yeah, there would be more of whatever happened in India, this and that. They don't have, unless, I think Prabhupada will also keep whatever correspondence he got back. So I think they have also a lot of letters from before coming.
I think sometimes even that there would be two copies. One to send and one to keep.
Okay. That's also, yeah, that's very pukka. Because then you know what you sent otherwise.
I remember reading some places. I think in TKG's diary a few times, something like that.
Prabhupada would do like that. Yeah, because TKG was the secretary.
It's like email, you send an email, but you have a copy.
You have a copy with you, yeah, yeah. You know what you have, yeah. Yeah. Yes, no? Maybe? Possibly? Possibly, okay. Srila Prabhupada, The Agarwals had looked curiously at the photograph, quote, "There'll be no mistake here," Gopal had said. The unsuspecting Agarwals were, quote, "simple American people," end quote, according to Sally Agarwal, who had met her Indian husband while he was working as an engineer in Pennsylvania. What would they do with an Indian Swami in their house? Prabhupada was a shock for them, but there was no question of not accepting him. They were bound by the request of Gopal's father. Dutifully, Gopal had purchased Srila Prabhupada's ticket from New York to Pittsburgh and had arranged for the agent from Traveler's Age to meet him, and dutifully had driven tonight to meet him. So it was a mixture of embarrassment, disbelief, and wonder that Gopal Agarwal helped his guest into the VW and drove back home to Butler. What's a VW? Volkswagen. Yes.
Must have been a combi van.
Yeah, yeah. No, it said it was a van. Where is it? Yeah, with a family Volkswagen bus. Right? So that would have been. September 20th, Butler, Pennsylvania, home of the Jeep. End quote. So this must be from Prabhupada's diary. Butler, Pennsylvania, home of the Jeep. Right? What's the Jeep?
Type of car.
Type of car. I guess you could say it's a type of car. Type of car that has no top on it and no doors, right? Yeah. So a fancy form of it is a Scorpio. That's a Jeep with doors on it. But otherwise, previously they're just like square boxes, basically, that are open and very strong. And, you know, you'll use them off-road and all that. But those days, off-road was not glamorous. It was, you know, just practical. So they were very, very tough. I think they designed the Jeep back in the 40s or something for use in World War II and the deserts of Africa and stuff like that. And the same exact design is still used today. It works so good. So Butler, Pennsylvania, that's the home of the Jeep. Okay, so now you know. So just be happy to. Butler, Pennsylvania, home of the Jeep, read a granite plaque in the city park. Butler, famous as the town where the U.S. Army Jeep was invented in 1940, was an industrial city of 20,000, settled amid the hills of an area rich in oil, coal, gas, and limestone. Its industry consisted mainly of factories for plate glass, railroad cars, refrigerators, oil equipment, and rubber goods. 90% of the local laborers were Native Americans. Wow, so many Americans there. Oh, must be because that's where the Iroquois and all that, all that side. The nominal religion had always been Christianity, mostly Protestant with some Catholic, and in later years a few synagogues had appeared. But there was no Hindu community at that time. Gopal Agarwal was the first Indian to move to Butler. As the VW bus pulled into town, the pre-dawn air was warm and humid. The morning edition of the Butler Eagle would soon be going to the newsstands. Quote, Red Chinese fire on India, end quote. Prime Minister Shastri declares Chinese communists out to dominate world. United Nations Council demands Pakistan and India cease fire in 48 hours. These are the headlines. Srila Prabhupada arrived at the Agarwal's home, Sterling Apartments, at 4 a.m., and Gopal invited him to sleep on the couch. Their place, a townhouse apartment, consisted of a small living room, a dining room, a kitchenette, two upstairs bedrooms, and a bath. What's a kitchenette? A small kitchen, right? You have a kitchen, so a kitchenette means it's really small. You somehow or another have a stove and this in there, and basically, if you can stand inside, you're doing good. But if two people would have problems, generally.
We have a kitchenette.
Oh, up there, yeah, small kitchen.
compared to the hut.
Yeah, compared to the hut, yes. Okay, so the little huts up here, these are kitchenettes, so it's down there, that's the kitchen. Okay. Well, these guys, you put two guys anywhere together, they don't quite fit somehow. They always fight. Even there's one veranda, two of them have that somehow. No, they don't quite. So I guess even the big kitchen would be still a kitchenette for these guys. So. Here they lived with their two young children. The Agarwals had lived in Butler for a few years now and felt themselves established in a good social circle. Since their apartment had so little space, they decided it would be better if the Swami took a room at the YMCA and came to visit them during the day. Of course, living space wasn't the real difficulty. It was him. How would he fit into the Butler atmosphere? He was their guest, so they would have to explain him to their friends and neighbors, right? Because you know, everyone's going to ask him, you know, what's with the guy with the pointy shoes? Right? Srila Prabhupada was immediately a curiosity for whomever saw him. In anxiety, Mrs. Agarwal decided that instead of having people speculate about the strange man in orange robes living at her house, it would be better to let them know about him from the newspapers. She explained her plan to Prabhupada, who laughed, understanding that he didn't fit in. Sally hurried Prabhupada off to a Pittsburgh newspaper office, but the interviewer wasn't able to comprehend why this person should make an interesting story. Sally then took him to the local Butler Eagle, where his presence was accepted as indeed newsworthy. Right, because the local town newspaper, you know, anything, you know, somebody yawns, you know, it's something to put in the paper. But, you know, these big newspapers are only international or, you know, news or big national news. But this is the local city newspaper, so. September 22nd. A feature article appeared in the Butler Eagle. Quote, "In fluent English, devotee of Hindu cult explains commission to visit the West," end quote. A photographer had come to the Agarwal's apartment and had taken a picture of Srila Prabhupada standing in the living room holding an open volume of Srimad Bhagavatam. The caption read, quote, "Ambassador of Bhakti Yoga," end quote. The article began. A slight brown man in faded orange drapes and wearing white bathing shoes stepped out of a compact car yesterday into the Butler YMCA to attend a meeting. He is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swamiji, a messenger from India to the peoples of the West. The article referred to Srimad Bhagavatam as biblical literature and to Srila Prabhupada as the learned teacher. It continued, quote, "My mission is to revive a people's God consciousness," says the Swamiji. "God is the father of all living beings in thousands of different forms," he explains. "Human life is a stage of perfection in evolution. If we miss the message, back we go through the process again." He believes. Bhaktivedanta lives as a monk and permits no woman to touch his food. On a six-week ocean voyage and at the Agarwal apartment in Butler, he prepares his meals in a brass pan with several levels for steaming rice, vegetables, and making, quote, bread at the same time. He is a strict vegetarian and is permitted to drink only milk. Quote, "The miracle food for babies and old men," end quote. He noted, "If Americans would give more attention to their spiritual life, they would be much happier," he says. The Agarwals had their own opinion as to why Prabhupada had come to America. Quote, "To finance his books and nothing more." They were sure that he was hoping only to meet someone who could help him with the publication of his Srimad Bhagavatam, and that he did not want any followers. At least they hoped he wouldn't do anything to attract attention. He wouldn't end up with followers. Right? And they felt that this was his mentality also. Quote, "He didn't create waves," Sally Agarwal says. "He didn't want any crowd. He didn't want anything. He only wanted to finance his books." Perhaps Prabhupada, seeing their nervousness, agreed to keep a low profile out of consideration for his hosts. At Srila Prabhupada's request, however, Mr. Agarwal held a kind of open house in his apartment every night from 6 to 9. Sally, "It was quite an intellectual crowd that we were in, and they were fascinated by him. They hardly knew what to ask him. They didn't know enough. This was just like a dream out of a book. Who would expect to meet a Swami in someone's living room in Butler, Pennsylvania?" Right? The home of the Jeep, right? "It was just really tremendous. In the middle of middle-class America, my parents came from a quite distance to see him. We knew a lot of people in Pittsburgh, and they came up. This was a very unusual thing, having him here, but the real interest shown in him was only as a curiosity. He had a typewriter, which was one of his few possessions, and an umbrella. That was one of the things that caused the sensation, that he always carried an umbrella. It was a little chilly, and he was balding, so he always wore this hat, and someone had made for him, like a swimming cap. It was a kind of sensation." That was, you know, the Swami hats, the Vrindavan hats. "He was so brilliant that when he saw someone twice, he knew who they were. He remembered. He was a brilliant man. Or if he met them in our apartment and saw them in a car, he would remember their name. and he would wave and say their name. He was a brilliant man. All the people liked him. They were amazed at how intelligent he was. The thing that got them was the way he remembered their name and his humorous way. He looked so serious all the time, but he was a very humorous person. He was forbidding in his looks, but he was very charming. He was the easiest guest I have had in my life, because when I couldn't spend time with him, he chanted, and I knew he was perfectly happy. When I couldn't talk to him, he chanted. He was so easy, though, because I knew he was never bored. I never felt any pressure or tension about having him. He was so easy that when I had to take care of the children, he would just chant. It was so great. When I had things to do, he would be happy chanting. He was a very good guest. When the people would come, they were always smoking cigarettes. But he would say, "Pay no attention, think nothing of it." That's what he said, "Think nothing of it." Because he knew we were different. I didn't smoke in front of him. I knew I wasn't supposed to smoke in front of Gopal's father. So I sort of considered him the same. He didn't make any problems for anyone. Right, so Prabhupada, very good guest, and he was just there and tried to make no difficulty or anything like that. And, you know, so, because taking care of a guest, you want to always take care, see they're happy, see they're satisfied, but he was happy just to chant. So if she had other things to do, she didn't have to worry about him. She didn't say, you know, she had to take care of the kids, he'd chant. She had other things to do, he'd chant. So whatever it was, he'd just sit and chant. Then others would come, you know, because their habits, they would smoke and this and that. And he'd say, yeah, no, don't worry about it. You know, pay no attention. You know, don't, you know, he wasn't in anxiety about it because that's the way they are. So he was just happy to be like that. One evening, a guest asked Prabhupada, "What do you think of Jesus Christ?" And Prabhupada replied, "He is the Son of God." Then he added that he, the guest, was also a Son of God. Everyone was interested to hear the Swami accepted Jesus as the Son of God, Gopal. His intent was not to have you change your way of life. He wasn't telling anyone they should be vegetarian or anything. All he wanted you to do was to follow what you are, but be better. He didn't stress that we should give up many things. Srila Prabhupada followed a regulated daily schedule. Every morning he would walk the 6 or 7 blocks from the YMCA to Sterling Apartments, arriving there about 7. When he had first landed in New York, he had in his luggage a large bundle of dried cereal, similar to rolled oats. The supply was enough for several weeks, and every morning at breakfast he would take some with milk. At 7:45, Gopal would leave for work, and around 9:30, Prabhupada would start preparing his lunch in the kitchen. He made his chapatis by hand, without even a rolling pin. He worked alone for 2 hours, while Mrs. Agarwal did housework and took care of their children. At 11:30, he took prasadam, Sally. When he cooked, he used only one burner. The bottom-level pot created the steam. He had the dal on the bottom, and it created the steam to cook many other vegetables. So for about a week, he was cooking this great big lunch, which was ready about 11:30. And Gopal always came home for lunch about 12. I used to serve Gopal a sandwich, and then he would go back to work. But it didn't take me long to realize that the food the Swami was cooking, we'd enjoy too. So he started cooking that noon meal for all of us. Oh, and we enjoyed it so much. Our fun was to show him what we knew of America, and he had never seen such things. It was such fun to take him to the supermarket. He loved opening the package of okra or frozen beans. What's okra? Bendi, yeah. And he didn't have to clean them and cut them to do all those things. He opened the freezer every day and just chose his items. It was fun to watch him. He sat on the couch while I swept with a vacuum cleaner, and he was so interested in that. And so we talked for a long time about that. He was so interesting. Right? Prabhupada wanted to know everything. Like later when he was in New York, he many times just, you know, before everything started, he'd just get in the bus and drive around town, walk around town until he knew everything, what every street was, what was where, you know, what happened in every part of town and that. So he knew everything about the place.
Probably knew more than the locals.
Yeah, probably knew more than the locals. Yeah, I think there's one place in here where he's telling someone how to get to some place like that. So every day we'd have this big feast and everything. Yeah, this is rice, dal, sabji, chapatis. So that's a big feast, right? Because yeah, otherwise it's a sandwich. Okay. So every day we'd have this big feast and everything was great fun. We really enjoyed it. I would help him cut the things. He would spice it, and we would laugh. He was the most enjoyable man. Most enjoyable man. I really felt like sort of a daughter to him, even in such a short time. Like he was my father-in-law. He was a friend of my father-in-law, but I really felt very close to him. He enjoyed everything. I liked him. I thought he was tremendous. After lunch, Prabhupada would leave about 1 p.m., and walked to the YMCA, where the Agarwals figured he must have worked at his writing until 5. He would come back to their apartment about 6 in the evening, after they had taken their meal. They ate meat, so Mrs. Agarwal was careful to have it cleared away before he came. Then one night he came early. She said, "Oh, Swamiji, we have cooked meat, and the smell will be very disagreeable to you." So he said, "Okay, think nothing of it, think nothing of it." In the evening, he would speak with guests. The guests would usually take coffee and other refreshments, but he would request a glass of warm milk at 9 o'clock. He would stay speaking until 9:30 or 10, and then Mr. Agarwal would drive him back to the YMCA. Prabhupada would also do his own laundry every day. He washed his clothes in the Agarwal's bathroom and hung them to dry outside. He sometimes accompanied the Agarwals to the laundromat and was interested to see how Americans washed and dried their clothes. To Sally, he seemed, quote, "very interested in the American ways and people," end quote. Sally: "Our boy Bridge was 6 or 7 months old when the Swami came, and the Indians love boys. The Swami liked Bridge. He was there when Bridge first stood. The first time Bridge made the attempt and actually succeeded, the Swami stood up and clapped. It was a celebration. Another time our baby teethed on Swami's shoes. I thought, oh, those shoes, they've been all over India and my kid is chewing on them." You know how a mother would feel, right? Almost every night, he used to sit in the next door neighbor's backyard. We sat out there sometimes with him, or we stayed in the living room. One time something happened with our little girl, Pamela, who was only 3 years old. I used to take her to Sunday school, and she learned about Jesus in Sunday school. Then when she would see Swamiji with his robes on and everything, she called him Swami Jesus. And this one time, when it first dawned on us what she was saying, she called him Swami Jesus, and Swami smiled and said, "And a little child shall lead them." It was so funny, because right? Jesus said that same thing. Prabhupada spoke to various groups in the community. He spoke at the Lions Club in early October and received a formal document from the document. "Be it known that A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami was a guest at the Lions Club of Butler, Pennsylvania, and as an expression of appreciation of services rendered, the club tenders this acknowledgement." He also gave a talk at the Y and at St. Fidelis Seminary School. She's a saint. The Y, what's the Y?
YMCA.
Yeah, the YMCA. What's the YMCA?
Place where they do some like exercises and stuff.
Do some exercises. It's a gym. YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association. That's what the Y is. Well, I mean, they always have a place to do exercises. You know, there's always something to eat. There's a pool table. There's a ping pong table. There's a gym. You know, there's a swimming pool like that. That's all at the Y, and rooms to stay. Right, so it's for, it's like a you know, kind of like a dormitory hotel kind of thingy for yeah, dharmshala, Christian dharmshala, yes, for men to say, right. And the women's is YWCA, like that. And Saint Fidelis. Saint Fidelis Seminary College in Herman, Pennsylvania. And he spoke regularly to guests at the Agarwals' home. When Professor Larson, the chairman of the philosophy department at Slippery Rock State College, read in the... Okay, Slippery Rock State College. Yeah. You kind of wonder, professor, like, you know, all 15 students.
Right?
Night students, yeah, yeah. You know, after they get work off at McDonald's.
Steel mill.
Yeah, the steel mill.
Study philosophy at Slippery Rock.
Slippery Rock, yeah, okay. State College, okay. Read in the Butler Eagle of a visiting Indian Swami and Vedic scholar, he phoned the Agarwals' home to invite Prabhupada to lecture on campus. Alan Larson. I called the number given in the newspaper article, but it turned out that the Swamiji was actually staying in a room at the YMCA. When I arrived, he was waiting on the street corner, and I picked him up. He seemed very much alone. We were driving to Slippery Rock. When we were driving to Slippery Rock, I asked him to pronounce his name for me so I would have it right when I introduced him to my class. He said, Swamiji Bhaktivedanta. And then he proceeded to tell me what that meant. Since I was not used to Indian names, he had to repeat it several times before I got it right. He showed no impatience with my slowness. Even at this early junction of our association, I was convinced that this man had an inner stability and strength that would be very difficult to shake, and his initial impression was further reinforced throughout the rather busy day. 100 students from several classes had gathered to hear the lecture as Prabhupada, in his natural, unrehearsed manner, walked down the aisle, up the 3 wooden steps, and onto the plain wooden stage. He sat down, erect and cross-legged, and began softly singing Hare Krishna, his eyes closed. Then he stood and spoke, without a lectern or a microphone, and answered questions from the audience. The program lasted only 50 minutes and ended abruptly with a bell signaling the next class. Alan Larson. After the first class, I had a short conversation with the Swamiji while sitting outside on a bench on the campus lawn. Most of the time, when he was not directly engaged in conversation, he would repeat a short prayer while moving prayer beads through his fingers. He was sitting up cross-legged, and we were speaking back and forth. He said that the trees around us were beautiful. When he asked, what kind of trees are these? I replied, they're shade trees. Then he said it was too bad that they weren't fruit or nut trees to provide food and benefit people. At 1 o'clock, Prabhupada lectured again. Afterward, he accompanied Dr. Mohan Sharmer, a member of the faculty, who had attended the lecture, and his 16-year-old daughter, Minnie, to Mr. Sharma's campus residence. Prabhupada accepted warm milk and dried fruit, and at Dr. Sharma's request, blessed his home and touched the forehead of his daughter in a gesture of benediction. Around 3 o'clock, Professor Larson drove him back to Butler. Alan Larson. The Swamiji seemed to present himself as an Indian scholar who had come for a short time to do translation work. I never thought of him as a missionary, but during the course of the day, there grew in me a warm affection for this man, because he was unmistakably a good man who had found his way to a stability and peace that is very rare. John. Srila Prabhupada Ki. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna.